Welcome to Covenant Presbyterian Church in West Des Moines, Iowa. This educational offering is part of our mission to bless our neighbors to the glory of God. We hope it blesses you.
So we're going to talk about the International Day of Peace, which is today. How exciting is that? Very exciting. That's not the reason that we moved contemporary issues to Monday evenings, but it's convenient. So the International Day of Peace is a day that was designated by the United Nations General Assembly in 2001 as a 24-hour period of global ceasefire. So this time when folks who are at war with each other will take one day of peace. And we're going to hear in just a couple minutes from the founder of the International Day of Peace, and he'll tell us why he did this and what effect it has had. There is a local observance of the International Day of Peace, the Des Moines Faith Committee for Peace, and their 2020 theme is Shaping Peace Together. So we're going to talk about how we can shape peace together, because there's more to peace than just temporarily pausing violence, right? So the Faith Committee for Peace says true peace depends on societies being inclusive, healthy, and economically stable. It requires a predictable climate, an unpolluted environment, and solidarity across community lines. And the sort of the big event of the Des Moines observance of the International Day of Peace actually just ended. It was an ephemeral art installation in partnership between Des Moines and a city in New Zealand. So they've spent 12 hours building two dove eyes, one on Des Moines and one in New Zealand. And the idea is that the eyes of a dove are on the sides of its head, right? And so it's got a 340-degree field of vision. So it can see almost all the way around itself. So it can see in front of itself, it can look at you, but it can also look back there, not quite back there, but back there at the same time. By putting one eye here and one eye that many degrees away from us, the earth has become this dove that needs to look forward into signs of a world where there is peace. So is that cool? That's very cool. So this is ephemeral art. It is crafted today, The Faith Committee for Peace live streamed the final 30 minutes from 6:30 to 7 o'clock. And we'll put a link to that in the Covenant Corner tomorrow, where you can go watch that live stream of the final 30 minutes and just kind of some program that they've put together about the International Day of Peace. And then it's going to be deconstructed. It's actually all made out of birdseed. So it's going to be deconstructed and fed to actual doves. So how exciting is that, right? So it's like art imitates life, which is fed by the art. So the question we're going to come back to is, how can we shape peace together in this time of pandemic, uprising, and immense change? How can we shape peace together in this time of pandemic and uprising and immense change? So you're going to sit with that question while Jeremy Gilley talks to us about the International Day of Peace. And you should now be able to see that I'm about to start a video. Give me a thumbs up. Excellent. Everyone but Sue can see it. All right, here's Jeremy Gilley in 2011. This is when he shared these words with us.
I was basically concerned about what was going on in the world. I couldn't understand the starvation, the destruction, the killing of innocent people. I mean, making sense of those things is a very difficult thing to do. And when I was 12, I became an actor. I was bottom of the class. I haven't got any qualifications. I was told I was dyslexic. In fact, I have got a qualification. I got a D in pottery, was the one thing that I did get, which was useful, obviously. And so concerned is where all of this comes from. And then I, being an actor, I was doing these different kinds of things, and I felt the content of the work that I was involved in really wasn't cutting it, that there surely had to be more. And at that point, I read a book by Frank Barnaby, this wonderful nuclear physicist, and he said that media had a responsibility, that all sectors of society had a responsibility to try and progress things and move things forward. And that fascinated me, because I'd been, you know, messing around with the camera for most of my life, and then I thought, well, maybe I can do something. Maybe I can become a filmmaker. Maybe I can use the form of film constructively to in some way make a difference. Maybe there's a little change I can, you know, get involved in. So I started thinking about peace, and I was obviously, as I said to you, very much moved by these images, trying to make sense of that. You know, could I go and speak to older and wiser people who would tell me how they'd made sense of the things that are going on? Because it's obviously incredibly frightening. But I realized that, having been messing around with structure as an actor, that a series of sound bites in itself wasn't enough, that there needed to be a mountain to climb, there needed to be a journey that I had to take, and if I took that journey, you know, no matter whether it failed or succeeded, it would be completely irrelevant. The point was is that I would have something to hook the questions of, you know, is humankind fundamentally evil, is the destruction of the world inevitable, should I have children, is that a responsible thing to do, etc., etc. So I was thinking about peace, and then I was thinking, well, where's the starting point for peace? And that was when I had the idea. There was no starting point for peace. There was no day of global unity. There was no day of intercultural cooperation. There was no day when humanity came together, separate all of those things, and just shared it together, that we're in this together. And that if we united and we interculturally cooperated, then that might be the key to humanity's survival. That might shift the level of consciousness around the fundamental issues that humanity faces if we did it just for a day. So I, obviously, we didn't have any money. I was living in my mum's place. And, you know, we started writing letters to everybody. I mean, you very quickly work out, you know, what is it that you've got to do, you know, to kind of, you know, fathom that out. I mean, how do you create a day voted by every single head of state in the world to create the first ever ceasefire non-violence day, the 21st of September? And I wanted it to be the 21st September because it was my granddad's favorite number. He was a prisoner of war. He saw the bomb go off at Nagasaki. It poisoned his blood. He died when he was 11, died when I was 11. But he was like my hero. And the reason why 21 was the number is 700 men left, 23 came back, 2 died on the boat, and 21 hit the ground. And that's why we wanted it to be the 21st of September as the day of peace. So we began this journey, and we launched it in 1999, and we wrote to heads of state, their ambassadors, Nobel Peace Laureates, NGOs, faiths, you know, various organizations, literally wrote to everybody. And very quickly, some letters started coming back. And we started to, you know, sort of build this case. And I remember the first letter, one of the first letters was from the Dalai Lama, and of course we didn't have the money, we were playing guitars and, you know, getting the money for the stamps that we're sending out all of these emails. And a letter came through for the Dalai Lama saying, this is an amazing thing, you know, come and see me. You know, I'd love to talk to you about the first ever day of peace. And we didn't have the money for the flight. I rang Sir Bob Ayling, who was CEO of BA at the time, and said, mate, we've got this, you know, invitation, you know, could you give me a flight? You know, because we're going to go and see him. And of course, we went and saw him, and it was amazing. And then Dr. Oscar Arias came forward. And actually, let me go back to that slide, because when we launched it in 1999, this idea to create the first ever safe ceasefire and non-violence. We invited thousands of people, well not thousands, but hundreds of people, like lots of people, all the press, because we were going to try and create the first ever World Peace Day, a peace day. And we invited everybody, and no press showed up. I mean, there were 114 people there. They were mostly my friends and family. And that was kind of like the launch of this thing. But it didn't matter because we were documenting, and that was the thing. It's a win. You know, for me, it was really about the process. It wasn't about the end result. And that's the beautiful thing about the camera. They used to say the pen is mightier than the sword. I think the camera is, you know, and just staying in the moment with it was a beautiful thing and really empowering, actually. So anyway, we began the journey, and here you see people like Mary Robinson I went to see in Geneva. I'm cutting my hair. It's getting short and long because every time I saw, like, Kofi Annan, I was so worried that he thought I was a hippie that I, you know, cut it, and that was kind of what was going on. But I'm not worried about it now. But so Mary Robinson, she said to me, listen, this is an idea whose time has come. You know, this must be created. Kofi Annan said this will be beneficial to my troops on the ground. The OAU at the time, led by Salim Ahmed Salim, said I must get the African countries involved. Dr. Oscar Arias, Nobel Peace Laureate, president now of Costa Rica, said, you know, I'll do everything that I can. So, you know, I went and saw Amr Moussa at the League of Arab States. I mean, I met Mandela at the Arusha Peace Talks, and so on and so on and so on. Well, I was building the case to kind of prove, you know, whether this idea would make sense. And then we were listening to the people. I mean, we were documenting everywhere. 76 countries in the last 12 years I've visited. And I've always spoken to women and children wherever I've gone. I've recorded 44,000 young people. I've recorded about 900 hours of their thoughts. I'm really clear about how young people feel when you talk to them about this idea of having a starting point for their actions for a more peaceful world through their poetry, their art, their literature, their music, their sport, whatever it might be. And we were listening to everybody. And it was an incredible thing, you know, working with the UN and working with, you know, NGOs and building this case. I felt that I was presenting a case on behalf of the global community to try and create this day. And the stronger the case and the more detailed it was, the better chance we had of creating this day. And it was this stuff, actually, this, where I actually was in the beginning kind of thinking, no matter what happened, it didn't actually matter. You know, it didn't matter if I didn't create the day of peace. The fact is if I tried and it didn't work, then I could make a statement about how unwilling the global community is to unite. Until it was in Somalia where, you know, picking up that young girl and this young child who'd taken about an inch and a half out of her leg with no anesthetic, and that young boy who was a child soldier who told me he'd killed people, he was about 12. These things made me realize that this was not a film that I could just stop, and that actually at that moment something happened to me which obviously made me go, I am going to document, if this is the only film that I ever make, I'm going to document until this becomes a reality, because we've got to stop, we've got to do something where we unite separate from all the politics and religion that as a young person is confusing me. I don't know how to get involved in that process. And then on the 7th of September, I was invited to New York. The Costa Rican government and the British government had put forward to the United Nations General Assembly with 54 co-sponsors the idea of the first ever ceasefire non-violence day, the 21st of September, as a fixed calendar date, and it was unanimously adopted by every head of state in the world. Yeah. Yeah, the hundreds of individuals obviously made that a reality, and thank you to all of them. I mean, that was an incredible moment. I was at the top of the General Assembly just looking down into it and seeing it happen. And as I mentioned, when it started, we were at the Globe and there was no press. And now I was thinking, well, the press is really going to hear this story. And suddenly we'll start to institutionalize this day. And Kofi Annan invited me on the morning of the September the 11th to do a press conference. And it was 8 a.m. when I was stood there, and I was waiting for him to come down, and I knew he was on his way. And obviously, he never came down. The statement was never made. The world was never told there was a day of global ceasefire and nonviolence. And it was obviously a tragic moment for the thousands of people who lost their lives there and then subsequently all over the world. It never happened. And I remember thinking, you know, this is exactly why, actually, you know, we have to work even harder. And we have to make this day work. It's being created, nobody knows, but we have to continue this journey, and we have to tell people, and we have to prove it can work. And I left New York, you know, freaked, but actually empowered, and I felt inspired by the possibilities that if it did, then maybe we wouldn't see things like that. I remember, you know, sort of putting that film out and going, the cynics. I was showing the film, and I remember being in Israel getting absolutely slaughtered, you know, by some guys having watched the film, that, you know, it's just a day of peace. It doesn't mean anything. It's not going to work. You're never going to stop the fighting in Afghanistan. The Taliban won't listen, et cetera, et cetera. You know, it's just symbolism. And that was, like, even worse than actually what had just happened in many ways, because, You know, it couldn't. You know, it couldn't. It couldn't not work. I'd spoken in Somalia, Burundi, Gaza, the West Bank, India, Sri Lanka, Congo, wherever it was, and they'd all tell me, if you create a window of opportunity, we can move aid, we can vaccinate children. Children can lead their projects. They can unite. They can come together. You know, if people will stop, lives will be saved. That's what I'd heard, and I'd heard that from the people who really understood what conflict was about. And so I went back to the United Nations. I decided that I'd continue filming and make another movie. And I went back to the UN for another couple of years. We started moving around the corridors of the UN system and governments, you know, and NGOs, trying desperately to find somebody to come forward and have a go at it, you know, see if we could make it possible. And after lots and lots of meetings, obviously, you know, I'm delighted that this man, Ahmed Fawzi, one of my mentors and heroes, really, he managed to get UNICEF involved. And UNICEF, you know, God bless them, they said, okay, we'll have a go. And then UNAMA became involved in Afghanistan. There was this thought, well, could it work in Afghanistan with UNAMA and WHO and, you know, civil society, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it was like, and I was getting it all on film and I was recording it and I was thinking, you know, this is it. This is the possibility of it maybe working. But even if it doesn't, at least we've decided, you know, the door's open and there's a chance. And so I went back to London and I went and saw this chap, Jude Law, and I saw him because he was an actor, I was an actor, I had a connection to him because we needed to get some press, we needed some traction, we needed the media to be involved, because if we start pumping it up a bit, maybe more people would listen, and, you know, there would be more kind of like, you know, when we got into certain areas, maybe there would be more people kind of interested, and maybe we'd be helped financially a little bit more, which was, you know, desperately difficult, but I won't go into that. But, you know, so Jude said, okay, I'll do some statements for you. And whilst I was filming these statements, he said to me, where are you going next? I said, I'm going to go to Afghanistan. He's like, really? And I could sort of see a little look in his eye of interest. So I said to him, well, do you want to come with me? Do you want to come? You know, it would be really interesting if you came. It would help, and it would bring attention, and that attention would help kind of leverage the situation, you know, as well as all of the other sides of it. I mean, I think there's a number of pillars to success. One is you've got to have a great idea. The other is you've got to have a constituency. You've got to have finance, and you've got to be able to raise awareness. And actually, I could never raise awareness by myself, no matter what I'd achieved. So these guys were absolutely crucial. So he said yes, and we found ourselves in Afghanistan. It was a really, you know, incredible thing that when we landed there, you know, I was talking with various people and they were saying to me, you know, you've got to get everybody involved here. You can't just expect it to work. You have to get out and work. And we did. And we traveled around and we spoke to elders. We spoke to doctors. We spoke to nurses. We held press conferences. We went out with soldiers. We sat down with ISAF. We sat down with NATO. We spoke down with the UK government. I mean, we basically sat down with everybody in and out of schools, with ministers of education, holding these press conferences, which of course now was loaded with press. Everybody was there. There was an interest in what was going on. This amazing woman, Fatima Gilani, was absolutely instrumental in what went on. She was a spokesperson for the resistance against the Russians, and her Afghan network was just absolutely everywhere, and she was really crucial in getting the message in. And then we went home, and we'd sort of done it. We had to wait now and see what happened. And I got home, and I remember one of the team bringing in a letter to me from the Taliban. And that letter basically said, we'll observe this day. We will observe this day. We see it as a window of opportunity, and we will not engage. We're not going to engage. And that meant that, you know, humanitarian workers, you know, wouldn't be kidnapped, you know, or killed. And then suddenly, I obviously knew at this point there was a chance. And days later, 1.6 million children were vaccinated against polio as a consequence of everybody stopping. And, you know, like the General Assembly, obviously, the most wonderful, wonderful moment. And so when we wrapped the film up and put it together, because we had to go back, and we put it into Dari and Pashto, we put it into the local dialects, we went back to Afghanistan because the next year was coming, and we wanted to support, but more importantly, we wanted to go back, because these people in Afghanistan were the heroes. They were the people who believed in peace and the possibilities of it, etc., etc., and they made it real. And we wanted to go back and show them the film and say, look, you guys made this possible, you know, and thank you very much. And we gave the film over, and obviously, was, you know, it was shown and it was amazing. And then that year, 2008, this ISAF statement, Kabul, Afghanistan, September 17th, General Stanley McChrystal, Commander of International Security Assistance Forces in Afghanistan, announced today ISAF will not conduct offensive military operations on the 21st of September. You know, they were saying they would stop. And then there was this other statement that came out from the UN's Department of Security and Safety saying that Afghanistan, because of this work, the violence was down by 70%. 70% reduction in violence on this day of peace. And that completely blew my mind, kind of almost more than anything. And I remember being stuck in New York, this time because of the volcano, thankfully, I mean, which was obviously much less harmful. But I was there, and I was there thinking about what was going on, and I kept thinking about this 70% reduction in violence in what was what everyone said was completely impossible and you couldn't do. And that made me think that if we can get 70% in Afghanistan, then surely we can get 70% reduction everywhere. We have to go for a global truce. We have to utilize this day of ceasefire and nonviolence and go for a global truce. Go for the largest recorded cessation of hostilities, both domestically and internationally, ever recorded. It's exactly what we must do. And on the 21st of September this year, we're going to launch that campaign at the O2 Arena to go for that process, to try and create the largest recorded cessation of hostilities. And we will utilize all kinds of things, kind of dance and social media and visiting, you know, come to Facebook and visit the website and sign the petition. And it's in the 6 official languages of the United Nations. And we'll globally network with government, intergovernment, non-government, education, unions, sports. And you can see the education box there. We've got resources at the moment in 174 countries, trying to get young people to be the driving force behind the vision of that global truce. And obviously the life saving has increased, the concerts help, linking up with the Olympics. I went and saw Seb Coe. I said London 2012 is about truce. Ultimately that's what it's about. Why don't we all team up? Why don't we bring truce to life? Why don't you support the process of the largest ever global truce? We'll make a new film about this process. We utilize sport and football. On the day of peace, there's thousands of football matches all played from the favelas of Brazil to wherever it might be. So utilizing all of these ways to inspire, you know, individual action. And ultimately, we have to try that. We have to work together. And when I stand here in front of all of you and the people who will watch these things, you know, I'm excited, you know, on behalf of everybody I've met, that there is a possibility that our world could unite, that we could come together as one, that we could lift the level of consciousness around the fundamental issues brought about by individuals. I was with Brahimi, Ambassador Brahimi. I think he's one of the most incredible men in relation to international politics, you know, in Afghanistan, in Iraq. He's an amazing man. And I sat with him a few weeks ago and I said to him, Mr. Brahimi, is this nuts? I mean, you know, going for a global truce, is this possible? Is it really possible that we could do this? He said, it's absolutely possible. I said, what would you do? Would you go to governments and lobby and use the UN system? He said, no, I talk to the individuals. It's all about the individuals. It's all about you and me. It's all about partnerships. It's about your constituencies. It's about your businesses. You know, because together, by working together, I seriously think we can start to change things. And there's a wonderful man sitting in this audience, and I don't know where he is, who said to me a few days ago, he said, Jeremy, because I did a little rehearsal, and he said, I've been thinking about this day, you know, this day, and I've been imagining it as a square with 365 squares, and one of them's white. And it then made me think about a glass of water, which is clear. If you put one drop of something in that water, it'll change it forever. By working together, we can create peace one day. Thank you, Ted. Thank you. Thank you, thank you. Thanks a lot. Thank you very much. Thank you.
So peace, one day, or one day of peace, right? So when he gave this talk, he'd been at this for about 12 years. It had been official for about 10 years. And so he talked about what peace made possible. So he talked about peace making possible, that one day of peace made it possible for 1.6 million children to be vaccinated for polio, just in Afghanistan, right? All in one shot right there. What else would one day of peace, what would that make possible in the world?
Well, you know, I can't stand silence. It reminds me of a story about World War I on Christmas Eve. in trench warfare where the Germans were singing a hymn in German, but the tune was recognizable. And the next thing you know, both troops from the Germans, and I assume the English, might have been American, I'm not, excuse my history, came out of their trenches, continued singing at least for an evening. I'm not sure it was for a full day. And I thought that was so ironic that, and I can't imagine being in a trench, but both sides wanted to be anywhere but in that trench week after week. And they had that one, we'll call it one day, although it probably wasn't, of nobody shooting at them. And it happened to be Christmas Eve, and it was the song. And these are, I mean, actual shooting war going on, not subtle about it. So I guess that proved, at least for a couple of hours, warring factions can literally put that aside. Then the trick is, how do we then make it 2 days and then a week? And with that, I'll let someone else jump in.
If we had one day of peace, that would raise awareness everywhere of the fact that war is not normal or necessary and doesn't have to be our default mindset.
It seems kind of stupid for them to start up the next day fighting again if they were able to stop for one day. Why not think about a total ceasefire?
What about remembering, yes, I think my mic is on, yeah. What about thinking of the wars that happen? It's not the men who are fighting who are the decision makers, unfortunately. So I could see where orders may be given to continue, but that's not to say that there wouldn't be a 21st of October and a 21st of November. And then perhaps it could expand slightly, because you know how we know in the US how politicians are. Many countries deal with dictators, and it's all about having the biggest piece of the pie. And so the thing is, wouldn't it be wonderful if somebody's piece of the pie was a piece of peace? Just a segment of peace. But I am amazed how much he achieved in a year and a half to talk to all these people, and they agreed. And it was one country that came in and said yes, and then they got together, and it exponentially expanded, which, Sue, to your point and to Warren's point, exponential is, I feel, is let it grow. And how can it grow without getting those signals to the news? Did anybody hear anything on the news today about it being International Peace Day?
Yes.
You did? Oh, that little snippet on CBS tonight, but it was local. There was nothing national.
So what I love about the sort of the image that you offered there, Bev, of, okay, here was September 21st, and then September 22nd came, and everybody went back to fighting, but maybe there could be an October 21st out of that, and then a November 21st out of that, and sort of the piece that really grabbed me in the talk was the idea that this is a starting point, you know, that this is your foot in the door for, okay, we can get this amount of time when the things that are made possible by peace can happen, and we can be working on the things that make peace possible. Right, because as you said, it's not the, you know, it's not the people carrying the guns that make the decision to go back and fight on September 22nd. Right, somebody else, you know, with a fancier suit does that.
it was planted in their head that there is a day available to get out there and sing with the opposition.
And when we don't know what impact it has on each individual that might have been killed if we didn't have that one day that survived, or the one person it has an impact on, going to an event or hearing about it, and it makes a difference for that one individual and all the different people that has an impact on. Like, that's how it works. We start with one moment or one day, mm-hmm. and it expands.
And I think your key to the end of that one day at a time, one step at a time, one person at a time.
Look at all the times tragedy, like Ruth Bader Ginsburg, brings tons of people together, and John Lewis brings tons of people. They pause for peaceful moments and remembrance, and how great these people are as peacemakers. Yeah. But the trouble is, people have to die or get killed for that to happen. It's like, yeah. But it's refreshing to see the love for the people who are the leaders.
And fortunately, where we live, in the United States, those people have an opportunity to share and make radiance. And many of us don't feel that until it's too late.
Yeah.
Our lives have become so international because we can turn on 27 channels at any moment and see international this and programming from that I think we forget about the phrase that to think globally, act locally. I was thinking in particular that while I cannot stop a war in Sri Lanka tomorrow morning, I can make peace in my own circle. And that's what I've tried to do. I've been involved with the Presbyterian peacemaking efforts since I went on session, which is about 50 years ago. Not a little less, 45. But there has been little done, at least that was effective and that anybody was serious about making peace one person at a time. I worked on a committee that was supposed to make peace in congregations, but that really never got down to the individuals. It treated the whole thing as an amorphous glob of people who didn't like each other. And I thought that was the wrong idea.
So that brings us to sort of our big question here, how can we shape peace together? And the local Des Moines Faith Committee for Peace acknowledges, you know, the pandemic and the racial unrest around the country. They could have talked about the political sort of antipathy and gridlock that we've got as a country, just the amount of change that's going on. And so John is bringing us to making peace directly between people, as, you know, that's kind of a place where we can get purchase on this work of peace. How can we do that? How can we be part of that peacemaking?
If we take a moment to think about what's being said, for example, well, if Iran is going to do that to us, then we're going to have to take action. If we can just, in times like that, think of ways that we can say, no, that's not the only possible course. We can do other things.
I miss the opportunities to be at church and saying, may the peace be with you. It's such a powerful moment. Yeah.
Yeah, that just moving into that space and going through that ritual of passing peace to each other. Yeah. That there's something that takes hold during that.
As there should be.
Yeah. Oh, Warren's still muted. We'll get him here.
Lower left.
There he is.
I can't think of the term in sociology, but there's a triangle of your needs, you know, where you're down here, you're just surviving. I mean,
Maslow's hierarchy.
Thank you.
Of needs.
I was just a C student. But anyway, when you think a lot is being spent worldwide on military expenditures and how much shelter, and we've seen some new homes in El Salvador. Remember the cement block home with the concrete floor? I mean, we're not talking houses like we're living in, but shelter, food, medicine. I think Bill and Melinda Gates are doing a lot on worldwide, I don't know if it's polio, but anyway.
HIV.
And I don't have my numbers, but I know just what the Americans spend on military. An aircraft carrier would buy a whole lot of homes in El Salvador or provide for shelter. And I think back to the individual. I'm not going to be sure I can take care of the dictator, but I think the people are so dependent on the dictators for these Maslow's absolute basics at the bottom that I think that's one thing, and we're doing it in a small way with our El Salvador mission partnership with San Ysidro. But like I say, between all those Western European countries and China and Russia, what they spend on military, you could probably build a small concrete block home and have a basic diet and improved medical. Here's the asterisk, though. If we could control world population. So you got to be careful. The more, well, we're losing like 200,000 people in the U.S. this year, you know, famine, disease, war has traditionally reduced populations, but I think we'd have to put a qualifier in there is that these third world countries got healthier diets and all that they also didn't have larger families or, on the other side of the coin, increase the survival rate, and then we can outstrip. And I think our friend with the World Food Prize, Norman Borlaug, even mentioned that world population is a part of the solution, part of the formula that seems to kind of never. But anyway, like I said, I don't have the numbers, but I'm sure the military expenditures worldwide, you know, chicken in every pot and whatever, it could probably do it. But the dictator is skimming so much aid that goes never gets down to the roots. And I better, like I say, I get too lengthy here. Thank you.
You know, and there's a connection, I think, not just sort of at the level of the dictator, but the just that, you know, you've got the Maslow's hierarchy of needs and these really basic, you know, the basic needs that you've got to meet in some way. And there really is, you know, this is an old, you know, the old economics trade-off between guns and butter. You know, that the more you spend on one thing, the less you spend on another thing. But the, you know, if you follow that trade-off, as you say, Warren, you know, for the military budget, not only how many concrete block homes could you build around the world, But how, you know, how much would those concrete block homes around the world change what you feel like your military budget needs to be?
Well, going back, and like I say, I've only been to Africa, 4 countries in Africa, and 2 countries in Central America. That's about my only third world exposure. But I can see I'm either going to starve to death or my kids are going to starve to death if I don't go out and do something that maybe is not appropriate. When you get to that desperate, there's where I think this food, back to the Maslow's needs, that I don't have to agree to go out and basically take it from my neighbor across the border, and I just can't imagine how a parent, we're all exposed to what you'll do for your kids, not to justify war, but I think to justify that we have no resources, we're going to go and raid the next country that maybe has some grain, and possibly my kids will at least, you know, have a chance of survival, as opposed if I sit here and do nothing, I know it'll be death, and my own health will probably deteriorate my life expectancy. Like I say, it's hard to identify if you've not experienced it, and just a little exposure, like I say, with my trip to Africa and to El Salvador, and it's, well, anyway, I can't express myself.
You're doing a good job, Warren. We get it.
I go back to the 70s when we remember all the peace demonstrations and all the hippies, they went crazy, and probably the drugs, but we were marching for peace. And at the same time, Vietnam was happening, and the war was going on. It was a major conflict between the peaceniks and the other people, the establishment.
But we were allowed to express ourselves. You could march down the street with with people and lead a peaceful march easily. There was no looting. There wasn't, you know, we didn't have that element at that point, unfortunately.
We were in England last year or the year before, and went to the Abbey Road where the Beatles are. The Beatles were my heroes. Oh my gosh, the music was wonderful. And I had to pick up this bumper sticker, John Lennon, Give Peace a Chance. And it's just such a goosebump thing just to be on Abbey Road with where the Beatles were, and they hung out, you know, and they were peaceful. They had,
They smoked a lot of funny things.
They went to India and got high, but they were peaceful. I mean, they weren't hurting anybody.
Well, and I truly think those of us that do have peace in our lives, I mean, we are very blessed to be living where we are. And as Warren has witnessed third world on our travels, we have, but still there are families that do live in peace. It just seems like people at our level want that. And how do we stand up and let the higher ups know? How do they do that, Nathan? How do we get that done?
Sue wants in.
Okay. Oh, there you go.
My son-in-law grew up in California, and it was not unheard of. Every Christmas there would be fist fights in the family, and he learned to hate Christmas, but it was a time when the family got together and they were not happy with each other. I mean, there would be arguments that would turn into fistfights, and so, you know, you don't have to look outside your family sometimes to even find conflicts and how to make it more peaceful. And I mean, he's getting better now, but he still remembers all the, I mean, even when he went back to California one Christmas, they were fighting each other. So, you know, some families just aren't peaceful, you know, and to try and make peace within your own family is a challenge. You know, you don't have to look much further than your own family to.
And Sue, I think sometimes we think peace is a huge thing and we're too small to get to it. But each of our small choices and behaviors do affect the people around us. And so we do have an impact on them. I think if each of us gets up in the morning and thinks about peace and what we can do to promote it, if everyone's doing that, eventually we're going to have peace.
Yeah, I never think of fighting, you know, that doesn't occur to me to have in my own family. And he has come to realize that Christmas can be a peaceful social time, you know, and it's so, you know, you
joy.
You don't have to look very far for conflict and where you might help peace.
Yeah. It's all around us.
So September 22nd is on its way, and the ephemeral art installation that places dove eyes on the world, that's going to go away, just like the Day of Peace is itself kind of ephemeral as a single day, but it's a starting place. So here's your invitation to when September 22nd rolls around, which will be at roughly the same time for all of us, to, as Deb said, to get up and think, well, what little thing can I do for peace? Either directly with the people I've got access to, or with the people who kind of shape the way that my world relates to the worlds of people around me, whether that's people in El Salvador or people in anywhere else in the world. How do we tie ourselves together to become this movement toward peace? So that's your question for tomorrow.
Was there anything like the polio vaccinations or anything that today? Was there something planned?
That's a good question. I don't know the answer to. So you can do that.
I wondered that too.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's got to be more things going on. Something special must have happened somewhere in recognition of this day.
Yeah. And the UN website now has a page for the International Day of Peace. So that might be a place to look. I don't think I saw announcements of things that they were planning when I was getting all the materials together, but the UN website does have that Day of Peace material as well.
The local news, watch the 10 o'clock news, they will show, and also on
CBS.
On Facebook. They will show the art from the Coles Commons downtown and the efforts for peace. I just thought, you know, if we put we've been doing so much fighting about politics here. If we put peace on the ballot, how many would go for that? Duh.
Right.
Well, and maybe it takes someone bringing to light to the news teams, more than just somebody who's bigger than us doing something in Coles Commons. Maybe there's other things. I mean, locally, neighborhood, you know, next door, you know, the next door app that you can check on people. It's like, spread the word. September 21st is only the beginning. And, you know, maybe that's something. I know it sounds a little aloft, but it's just
possibilities.
Well, and Nathan, the other morning I asked a question about how do we get the news to the people who aren't watching the news? How do we get to the uprisers that are causing the dissension? How do we get to them? What's your answer for that? Please,
just keep trying.
Right.
Do you have any thoughts?
Keep trying.
You know, the
I don't know any.
Yeah, the place I would start thinking with that, I think, would be, you know, where's that uprising coming from, or where is the violence coming from? You know, so, you know, we had the September 21st happens and September 22nd comes along, and, you know, if we're talking about a, you know, organized military conflict, there's, you know, some brass somewhere who decided, or, you know, some, you know, civilian head of state who decided to send the soldiers off to do the thing. And, you know, the soldiers are soldiers for particular reasons as well, whether they were conscripted or whether it was, you know, the way that they, you know, the way that they opted to serve the country. Whichever country we're talking about. But, you know, there's something behind the conflict, right? There's something behind the violence. And so, you know, how do we shift to the, okay, what is it that, you know, that has you rising up? What is it that has you deciding that violence is the way to meet whatever need it is, because, you know, violence, I'm quoting somebody else here, or I'm actually adapting from another topic, but they say, violence is not a problem, violence is a solution. And you can't get rid of violence without solving the problem that the violence is a solution to.
Hang on just a second.
Yeah.
So
you have to take a step backwards to figure out what the problem was that caused the violence.
Right.
And that's what's happening here right now with Black Lives Matter is, yes, there's some looting and yes, there's burning and there's other things going on. But Black Lives Matter started because a group of people weren't being heard. So once we start giving them a voice and listening to them, some of the violence that's happened doesn't need to happen.
Bev, I muted you while the phone was ringing.
Thank you for doing that, Nathan. Bruce's daughter called. The thing that I keep thinking is we need to start local. And, you know, it's intimidating. And maybe because of the unfamiliarity, that's how it all begins, right? Because we're not familiar with the other people and it's so much easier to avoid and to not be a part of it. But I think, you know, how do we approach that in this community? Because it will grow. And I'm sure there are other churches, other groups, non-affiliated with churches, that want this same thing. It would be interesting to see if
Jeremy Gilley.
Okay, Jeremy. It would be interesting to see exactly, you know, does he have faith or is he even doing this on his own as well? I mean, there are all kinds of us that have our own persona that we're dealing with, and for him to bring that together, and how amazing, and what a gift. What a gift to have. So do you have any suggestions to start local? Or is that not is it just something to think about?
I don't have here are the very first two things you can do. But we, so I'm a little unsettled about what topic we'll land on for next week. I've actually got something planned for you all in October, which gives me this one extra Monday to find something with. And I could see, there is, we have lifted up from time to time, here are some of the organizations in Des Moines that are doing this thing and that thing and that thing. That are addressing specific issues. It sounds like you're talking really about how do I
take a step
and step into sort of my neighborhood, however I'm going to say what my neighborhood is, and get to know the people who are making that neighborhood a better, more capital P peaceful place.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So one of the people that I met when we were looking at different mission groups was called Genesis. And that might be something, Nathan, that we could hear more about. And Genesis is a group in Des Moines that is meeting with a lot of people that have migrated here from third world countries. A lot of soccer or football is being played by the kids. Mm-hmm. And they're meeting at the Franklin
right.
Junior High, yeah. They're meeting there, and they are working to pull these kids together to give them and meet their needs so that they don't end up in violent situations as they move into adolescence. And I don't know why that popped into my head as you were asking that, Bev, but it's a pretty neat group.
Okay.
And I think it's one of the groups that got listed as our mission group was coordinating things, but I'm not sure how far it went, what else we're doing yet to help Genesis. But it's one that I'm keeping in the back of my mind thinking I want to do more. I want to know more about this group. So
Yeah, that's a good thought. That's a good thought. Just, I know, those little mini libraries? About 4 months ago, the artisans in town were people who do big murals, and Ben Shu and all those people were making sheets. They were making pen and ink drawings and they were peace-filled. One of the artists had rows of homes. And so I took the theme at the top, we're in this together, and I printed off about 25 sheets and to go into one of those little mini libraries. And it was just a way for people to see, and I even put, I passed them out to local neighbors right here with a little, dollar box of color pencils. But it was something that I felt, it was just an artsy thing, but need to reach out. Yeah. I mean, that's a beginning, is just to reach out.
Well, Shoopy, my neighbor.
Yeah, exactly. But they're already ours, but we just have to, just kind of start somehow with
making connections.
Show of confident love.
Making connections.
Yes, positive. Well,
personal peace too, daily meditation. Okay. A daily meditation There you go.
Daily yeah. Word, all right.
Advertisement, yeah.
I think that there are 100 ways a day that we could look at, if we even opened our eyes, where we could see the economic and political violence we as a society do to people. And an example of fighting against that quietly but effectively is the volunteer we had years ago, a member of our congregation, who went to Hope Ministries at least once a week and cooked. And he was helping fight that kind of violence.
Yeah, that makes a difference. And or the Eddie Davis House, and I think they discontinued that. We did that.
We used to cook meals for him every month. Yeah.
It's that's a good point, John. And I am so thankful my kids do not watch the news. All of the trash that's happening in the news, and they give one little snippet of something good happened today at the very end.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, here's your little piece of cake. Now go about your way and don't let it be hard to sleep tonight because of all the violence that you're seeing. And I'm so glad my kids don't. I mean, they're older, but even so, my kids don't allow their kids to watch the news. It's just not fit. Oops.
We used to ask our second graders each year for the 30 years I taught second grade what they thought the world would be like when they were 100. And you'd get these very heavenly pictures with angels and little decrepit little men and women in wheelchairs, often of them. They had to be in their picture.
Cute.
And it was so fun to do that every year. They spent a long time thinking, and they had to write about it and draw it. And then it got more and more negative as the years went on. And we finally decided to stop asking. Now, as an older person, I'd love to go back and, instead of saying, what do you think the world's going to be like when you're 100? What can you do to make the world a better place when you're 100? And I bet that would have changed their perspective, and we could have found more joy back when we decided to stop.
Isn't it interesting how the view literally has changed?
Yeah.
That's spot on, Deb. That's a good one.
At my mother's adult daycare center, when she was 98, they would ask 20 questions. And I went in one day, and she didn't know I was there. And they asked her, what do you think you're going to be doing in 20 years? And she piped up and said, I'll be playing a harp. That's
that's an easy answer.
Yeah. That's pretty amazing. You're right. Just even 5 years from now. Go ahead.
Getting back to motivation and what we can do individually, I have been around Polk County since my days at Drake, which were the early 60s. So I've always kind of been interested in the neighborhood surrounding Drake. And watched being able to walk on a Sunday night from Drake East to 19th Street and never even worry about it. Claudia and I had to find someplace to eat on a Sunday night. To in 2020, two young kids, both armed, happened to attempt to rob a guy who was licensed to carry.
Yeah.
You know, I it's not Chicago. It's not Detroit. This is I have a fondness for the Drake area and Des Moines. Claudia and I made a deliberate decision that when I was looking for employment, we were going to stay within driving range of our home in West Des Moines. We like Des Moines, greater Des Moines area. And it saddens me that it has come to us. Two kids, and this is like 2 o'clock in the morning. I think they were like 11 and 12 year olds. Yep. And this guy just happened to be licensed to carry. And I'm 77 now, as far as my years remaining in motivation, there's a trend there that troubles me. And I'm sure the Drake administration is troubled. And I'm not saying that we don't have international objectives, but I think for me, trying to salvage the area around Drake is something that would interest me. What to do? Once again, I got the questions. I don't have the answers. But this last couple of months has been a wake-up call, how I was not aware of the civil unrest that was kind of simmering under the peaceful facade. It's been, and then, like I say, just within a couple of weeks or 10 days ago, that really hit me. Two kids packing in an area where I used to live and walk around with no more fear. This is troubling to me.
You know, I left, I don't know if I muted or not. No, I left Chicago, and we were going to bring our kids up, and we didn't want to be in the Chicago area. So my mom has been mugged. My brother has been mugged. They do not live in Chicago. They live on the south side, right outside the city limits. And it's not a safe place for them to be. So we did not go back there. Once we started having kids, we stayed in Des Moines. Two blocks away from my house a couple of years ago, the police officer was ambushed and killed. That was two blocks away. I mean, we woke up in the night hearing the gunshots. They're far louder than you imagine. And my friends in Chicago, oh my goodness, did I have a lot of feedback on that.
Really?
Because why didn't you come home? You could have had the same thing happen here. Well, for us, it was a very unusual thing. In Chicago, it's happening all around them on a continual basis. It's really gotten bad there. But in Des Moines, it's still a very, we talk about those that have been murdered, those crimes that have happened around us, because they're not so plentiful that we aren't noticing them.
And the nice thing is, at least we're aware when it does happen, because it is rare. Yeah.
Right, because it's unusual. Yeah, exactly. But I think we keep reaching out and keep trying to find connections and doing the mission work that Covenant's doing and continuing to look for our neighborhood, our neighbors of our church neighborhood, and seeing how we can help and assist those families as well.
Well, and starting with the Faith Garden,
yeah,
that's, you know, that's amazing how many pounds of food go out and how many lives you're touching with that. And that's a manual labor, so an overseer. So that is just so, in my face, so obvious.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you're a small community and a lot happens. And because of the unity, that's a good thing.
Russ and Mary are the most loving, peaceful people.
Yeah.
And it goes back a long, long, long time. When we first moved to the neighborhood, we came to Covenant. Russ was the first one to welcome me in the door, like, come on in. And I was so impressed. And he's welcomed so many people into Covenant just by being a friend, reaching out.
Russ,
yeah.
You made a huge impression on Bruce, and to this day I notice. I mean, he does what you did to him. If he sees a face that he's not familiar with, he reaches out to them. And he has told a lot. I mean, he told me within the first probably, oh, I don't know, maybe first 6-8 months that I knew him, that you had done that. You and Mary were really instrumental. So you have made a great impression on me. I hope we do the same time sometime for someone else.
Pass it forward.
Yeah.
Pass it forward.
Pay forward. Yeah. Or
Bruce, I think Russ and Mary probably have at least five pastors that wish that they hadn't have been so friendly that day.
When I'm swinging my club tomorrow,
step back, Warren.
Warren, watch yourself.
Before we moved here, we were in Champaign, Illinois, and so when some people who had joined the church there that had come from West Des Moines, they found out where we were going. They said, "Oh, you got to check out Covenant. It's a very friendly place, a very friendly church." So, when we came here, and we visited Covenant, and then we visited some other places, and we kept coming back. And it got to the point where Scott, who was three and a half, he started calling Covenant my church.
Aww.
And one of the families there was the Fransons. They had kids the same age as ours, very close. And they were very, very welcoming, took us in. So it's a reputation Covenant has had for a long time, and we were very happy to do our best to keep it going.
In one of our last meetings here, I quizzed Sue and Ann and the people that came over from Windsor. I says, what brought you all over at the same time?
From Cottage Grove, yeah.
Cottage Grove. There you go. Thank you.
And your answer?
Well, yeah. You were the friendliest ones. Marilyn Johnson grabbed Ann's arm and said, come on in.
Yes, she did.
But, no, I was always pushing for Covenant when we were visiting other churches. I they were okay, but they didn't have children around. There wasn't, and I knew the mission work wasn't quite there. And they were, a lot of the churches are going to be, terminating in the next few years
because
they don't have people. And I just knew this was the place to be. And we tried to get Roberta and her mother and Jean Kinsey to join us, but they joined St. Paul's, but we tried, but we did get Bob Reese to come in. It was you guys have done it for us. We knew we were home.
And it feels like you've always been at Covenant, Sue. Yeah. Like you're just feel so close to all of you. You were a perfect fit. We love you.
And I think that the point this is coming to is that making peace can be as simple as shaking somebody's hand.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Thanks, John. Yeah.
And how long that stuck with? I mean, a simple gesture is just a nice.
If this COVID would just go away, we could
shake hands again. Yeah.
I know.
So I think maybe I'm going to bring that'll be our question for next week. And I don't know what our angle into talking about it will be, but our question for next week will be, how do we make those connections with people during a time of COVID? By my accounting, looking at the state coronavirus dashboard, we're in for a while like this. And so what do we, how do we build community in the midst of where we are right now? So that'll be our question for next week. I don't know how we'll start answering it, but.
Thank you for listening. Learn more about our mission at wdmcovenant.org.